Well, we'd like to welcome everybody tonight. Thank you for taking the time to join us for the such an important subject we have. We've put together an incredible lineup of global speakers on this, really to help push this forward across society. We're excited to have about 10 countries participating and people from all over the world with us today. So I'd like to see, you know, how everybody's feeling right now after watching that movie. I was going to have an opening, but every time I see that, I was just shocked. I was thinking, what would it be like having to live in that place, the Chewong River, where plastic and waste is polluting the waters, your environment? Today, we're talking not about plastic waste. We're talking about our health. We're talking about our overall environment for society. What are a few words that some of you might throw up in the chat, and how are you feeling now? It'd be great to have your chat and talk a little bit about this throughout the time that we're here, just to get everybody participating in the conversation along the way. But at this time then, we got motivated. Jeremy's motivated. How is anyone else feeling? I think to me, I was scared. I think that it was a big part about my personal part of this was out of sight, out of mind. And watching the movie, The Story of the Plastic, was interesting because we had to come all the way back to the beginning part of this. It's not just waste at the end and how do we recycle this. It's the whole chain of events that we go through. And today we're going to talk about that. We've got horrified, you know, actually, what is it going to take to motivate us? Overwhelmed, passionate to combat it, which is critical for us, you know, determined. These are great words that we all like to see and participate and ready to take massive changes. But the most important thing, Jake, is also it's not massive changes, it's the small steps. It's every little step that we take together. How are we talking to our governments about our companies, our friends? How do we act in everyday life to take action around this? So with that, I'd like to get this kickstarted and get right to some of our speakers. Our first speaker, Tiza Mathina. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Indonesia Plastic Bag Movement. She was a 2018 UN Ocean Hero. She was one in the video. She's featured in the Story of Plastic film. She was taking us on this journey down the Chewong River outside of Jakarta. Tiza, how are you doing?
Hi, Darren, and hi, everyone. Very happy to be here.
Well, thank you. And we'll go ahead and just give us a little intro about yourself and the plastic bag movement.
I am a co-founder and executive director of the Indonesia Plastic Bag Diet Movement. It's a nonprofit organization based in Jakarta, Indonesia, where I was born and raised. And what we do is we focus on policy change to push for single-use plastic reduction through social awareness, through collaborations with the private sector, and through advocacy to government stakeholders. And I guess, you know, should I talk a little bit more, Darren, or did you want to have me focus on a few specific things? Takeaways or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's your interesting about starting your plastic bag movement. What was that and how did you get involved into this? And tell us a little bit about that and what your involvement in Indonesia overall is.
Sure. So, you know, you saw that scene where I was going through the Chewong River. That river is actually close by to where I live. But like many residents of Jakarta, we don't really see it. It's behind, you know, several layers of establishments, housing. It's not used for transportation. It's not used for anything much. So when a bunch of my friends and I did this river tour at some point because we wanted to see whether there was a lot of trash there, we were completely blown away that something that was so close to where we live was actually so horrifying. And that kind of emphasizes what you said earlier, Darren, about how waste is often thought of as something that's out of sight, out of mind, and that has affected our behavior, which is that when we think of waste, we just think it of something that should be disposed of. Whereas the reality is that it's never really disposed of. We never really throw it away. We just move it from one place, from our home to another place. And oftentimes that other place is nature. That other place is a river and an ocean. And we haven't really come to terms with, you know, admitting that this waste problem just never really goes away. So what we did, like 7 years ago, we started this organization, and initially we were focusing on how do we create behavioral change? How do we get society to move away from, let's start with the easy single-use plastics that everybody uses. Let's start with plastic bags. It's pointless. It's completely free, and everybody uses it way too much. And so we started with educational campaigns and the kind of the plastic bag robbery thing that you saw in the short clip just now. But then after a while, you know, as we delved deeper, we figured out that it's the wrong, like, individuals shouldn't be responsible for such a huge endeavor. The product that we're dealing with is a mass produced product, and it's going to get used no matter whether we need it or not, simply because the supply is so massive. So in behavioral change can't really be effective if we start with, you know, small individual changes alone, but it's behavioral change is driven by corporate marketing. It's driven by policy changes. And once we figured that out, we changed our tactic, and then we decided to focus on how do we get corporations to change the way that they market these plastic bags? How do we get retailers to stop giving them away for free? How do we get government, regional governments to create policies that will limit the use of plastic bags? And so 7 years on, we've managed to get 20 cities in Indonesia to ban single-use plastic bags. And as of July, our capital city, Jakarta, will have started to ban its plastic bags, and that's a huge achievement for us.
That's such a wonderful thing to hear, and I got a quick question on that. When I first met you, you were talking about it, and watching it in the film, you were saying, you know, all I need to do is bring people down that river and let them experience what that experience was, seeing 5 meter high of this plastic trash along the rivers. What was that feeling for you? What was the first time that you experienced that? Tell us a little bit about what that journey is, and maybe perhaps that we should be bringing brands and these other places into these locations to help really feel it first person.
It was, the way I felt was I was horrified. And it just dawned on me actually that, okay, we can't undo this. We can't, unless we excavate the entire river. You know, it's not doable. So where do we go from here? Like, that was kind of, you know, a question that I had to think about for a while after my trip there. You know, as time went by and we made strategies and remade them and remade strategies and remade them. It was clear that the only logical way to go forward is to at least stop it from getting worse. And that requires massive change. It requires prevention and, you know, reduction and massive policy changes, as I mentioned.
Okay. Well, we'll get to those in a little bit. So I'd like to introduce our next panelist right now. Doug Woodring, from founder of Managing Director of Ocean Recovery Alliance. Doug's been one of those ones that's been absolutely amazing in really having a voice, creating projects across Asia and the world. He's been the UN Climate Hero, Google Earth Hero. He's taken on these projects like creating the skyscraper of the whale in Singapore, a huge whale that was built. In that, to really showcase the voice of how important it is that we all participate. And let's see, Ms. Doug, are you there?
Hi, Darren. How are you?
Hello, welcome. So tell us a little bit, or give us a quick background on Ocean Recovery Alliance and your role in this sustainable effort.
Sure. So I'm from California, but I've worked in Asia over 25 years. Part of my call, I'm the founder of Ocean Recovery Alliance, which is an NGO based here in Hong Kong, where I live, and also 501c3 in the US. But most of our work is global in nature, Hong Kong being a small city means everything has to be cross-border when you talk about solutions. And so we started very early on. I've been doing this for over 12 years. But my calling, I think, partly came from when my first job at university, I worked for one of the largest fishing companies in the world in Japan. I was the first foreigner working for them and trading seafood. And I really learned about the ills of the ocean and the amount of seafood being pulled out from it every day. And that made me think that someday when I have the capacity, when I'm older, I hope to help do something for the ocean. The other thing that really keeps me motivated is I do a lot of ocean sports and water sports. So I organize some of the largest open water swimming events in Asia and outrigger paddling. And so I'm in the water. I see it a lot more than maybe the normal person might see when they walk down the city street all the time. So we've done work with the UN and the World Bank. We're doing projects right now with the UN in Malaysia and Thailand on this topic. We just finished a big report for the UN where we scored 580 global commitments on plastic pollution by the private sector, public sector, and governments to show whether or not they were working well. And the theory was they weren't working that well, even though people made commitments, they didn't always follow through. We now have a whole new scorecard and toolkit that commitment makers can use for version 2.0 or for improving their existing commitments. And I think that's very important. So we do policy work, global thinking on cross-border implications, because especially with brands that export, plastic is used in countries all around the world, and some of those brands touch more than 200 countries, but the recycling and waste capacities in those countries isn't always up to speed to the context of where they were produced. We announced two projects 10 years ago, which are global tools for everyone, but they were probably 9 years too early. One is the Plastic Disclosure Project, which is a carbon report, and the other is our Global Alert app, which lets you report trash hotspots anywhere in the world's waters. That's already in Spanish. That was partly funded by the World Bank. And it's a bit like Waze for traffic. The challenge is we've built the back-end structure, but we need the communities and the stakeholders to use that tool for their management of their own watersheds. We also do education work and art, and we like making big noise with cool, creative things, as you suggested with the whale. And we run an event called Plasticity, which is all about finding solutions for second life plastic and how to reincarnate that waste. So of course we want to avoid material, but when we can't avoid it, we have to find another use for it so it doesn't get burned or dumped.
Great. Well, we're going to jump in a couple of those projects in the conversation, some fascinating projects you've done and really exciting. But right now, then, I'd like to jump on. We're going to move into our next panelist. The next panelist we have is Matt Reed, a really incredible social entrepreneur. He's the co-founder and director of Maximal Concepts, also the Steelhead Group, which he'll talk a little bit about now. And most importantly, it was part of Plastic Oceans, and they were the ones that brought together the movie with Craig Gleason, The Plastic Ocean. And even more exciting, they're in the middle of another huge documentary film that they're going to release at the end of this year, which I am looking forward to seeing, called The Last Glaciers. So Matt, how are you doing?
Good, good. Thank you for having me. And hello from Hong Kong. Good to be here. As you introduced, actually, my arrival into this experience was Craig Gleason. Came into my office 6-7 years ago with an iPad and played a 10-minute clip of what became A Plastic Ocean. And as a restaurateur, we were the protagonists. We were the ones putting the straws, wrapping everything, covering everything in cling film, with really no awareness that we were doing the damage to the planet. We were completely unaware. And my business partner, Malcolm Wood, and I turned to Craig and said, how can we help? And he invited us to join a Plastic Oceans charity, which we did. And collectively, as a charity, we brought that film you know, to the wider world. And we're very proud, and Craig is just a fearless warrior, traveling around the world consistently, you know, just building this awareness. And we've supported that in every way. And we've changed our own practices internally within our businesses. And in fact, we've now even now launched our own company, which is a B Corp, as a Plastic Conscious. And Plastic Conscious has been the next transition for us, which is about finding solutions. So it's all very well, awareness was key. But now, and actually we had a very similar feeling as to the basis of the story of plastic, where sort of at first you think, if everyone could just make a small change, would it make a big change? And of course there is a certain degree of that, but what we needed was systemic change, and systemic change came through innovation. It came through circular economies. It came through really looking at the life cycle of plastic and trying to find viable alternatives. And one of the things that we're really trying to help is the innovation exists, but they're normally way out of market on cost and potentially also not capable of marketing or selling to the right people. So we're trying to use our relationship in the small world that we're in, which is hospitality, and get multinational chains of hotels to absorb the cost of these solutions and therefore provide the economies of scale so that it would enable the mass market to change. So that's really been our primary focus in the last 2 years, is more around solutions. And as you kindly mentioned, we're doing our next film, but that's on climate change, and there's a whole nother conversation. So we'll leave that there.
We're going to pay attention to that one. You know, it's not only the last glacier, you know, glaciers from that, but it's also that you guys are doing adventure sports at the top of a number of these glaciers and showing this, right? So it's a interesting movie that we look forward to. But now let's jump over to Vic Saran, who is the director of materials at New Balance. He's responsible for the company's material operations and sourcing across Asia. Hello, Vic.
Hello, how are you?
How are you doing? Great, great. So tell us a little bit about your background. You've certainly had working with 20 years with these leading brands, Nike and all these large consumer good brands. So give us a quick intro on what your focus is.
Sure. So thank you for that, Darren. And thank you for having me, by the way. It's a privilege. My name is Vic Saran. I head up material operations and sourcing for New Balance. 96% of our sourcing activities take place over here in Asia. I've been working in the footwear industry for almost 3 decades now, having lived and worked in the US, South America, Indonesia. So I'm familiar with Tiza when she talks about the pollution in the rivers and things. I've seen it firsthand, having lived there for almost 5 years myself. Taiwan, Vietnam, and now Hong Kong for almost 5 years. My background includes having worked for some of our key brands in the industry. StrideRite, Reebok, Nike for 14 years. I was head of materials at Puma, and now I'm with New Balance. So I've worked in strategic business planning, operations, and sourcing, in finished shoes as well as in materials. I'm looking at my varied background, and I was asked once what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said a consultant, because of course, that given the background, that would be the obvious choice. And don't all kids say that? They want to be a consultant? But anyway, I mean, in all seriousness, I'm ashamed to say that brands have been a part of the problem, and I'm in that dubious group myself. For example, we produce shoes in Vietnam, Indonesia, China, India, Thailand. And where's the plastics problem the worst? In those very countries. Vietnam, Indonesia, China, I mean, and it's not for any fault of theirs, it's just the nature of the predicament that they're in because of the product they're dealing with. And so I want to be able to change that. I mean, Tiza is doing such admirable work, you know, with getting cities one by one to start, you know, banning single-use plastic bags and things. That is meaningful. That's actually is trying to tackle a problem from a solution standpoint. And we want to be a part of that solution too. So far, we've been a part of the problem. it's one of the reasons why I managed to hook up with Doug Woodring, who's on this call. He's a great guy. He's actually the missing link, in my opinion, on that reverse logistics of being able to harness communities to help with the recovery of some of that plastic trash that's clogging up our ecosystem, and being able to use it and reuse it and repurpose it so that we can at least get a handle on the problem, even though the faucet keeps pouring in, you know, fresh plastic for us to deal with. So hopefully further along in this call, we'll be able to address that as well. So Darren, that's pretty much the 3-minute pitch for me.
Thanks, Vic. Well, definitely about the role and responsibility of brands is a crucial part that we'll jump into really quickly here. And then the last panelist, I'd like to introduce Thomas Ball, who is the head of partnerships at the WWF in London, England. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Sorry, just unmuting myself. Very good. Thank you. And thank you for having me. And great to be speaking alongside all these great panelists and yourselves. So thank you. A quick intro into myself. So yeah, I head up partnerships in WWF UK. Hopefully you all know who WWF are. We're the world's leading conservation organization. And I work in the UK office. So my team, we manage a portfolio of partnerships across many world leading brands and organizations who we're working with. Many people who know WWF and love the work that we do are often surprised that we're working with businesses, but we see it as very much an important part of the work that we do to achieve our mission, because if we're not working with these businesses who are often some of the sources of the challenges which we're trying to tackle, then we wouldn't be able to tackle those problems in the first place. So plastics is obviously a key thing that we're working on, but it's across the spectrum of environmental issues, from climate change, carbon emissions, fixing the food system, tackling issues around different commodities like palm oil and soy, taking deforestation out of our food supply chains, working on the finance system, seeing how we can shift incentives so that we're not financing the destruction of nature and increasing the challenges of climate change. And working really with across governments, with people, and with the public and with businesses. And so really trying to see how we can tackle some of these systemic issues. With plastic in particular, we have a No Plastics in Nature initiative, which is to eliminate the leakage of plastic into nature by 2030. Hugely ambitious target. We have three sort of pillars across which we work, is around policy and business and through cities as well. And this is about sort of working towards creating a global binding international agreement that increases accountability across all stakeholders, because we see that as key. Obviously, as you've, some of the other panelists have been talking about, tackling the whole supply chain is one of the biggest problems that we face, because it can't all just be lumped with the end consumer and behavior changes, as much of that is as part of the challenge. But it's also about looking all the way across and how do we tackle this global problem, because it really is a global problem. It can't just be solved at one end and by one country. It has to be solved across multiple geographies. And that's hugely, hugely challenging. So we're looking to try and work with others, well, we are working with others to try and get a global agreement in place by 2021. Many of us are hopeful that we can do that, but it's very difficult, and that will have to be a legally binding agreement to end plastic pollution. So yeah, that's some of what we're working on at the moment.
Looking forward to seeing the results of some of that, some big steps, certainly. Well, at this point, why don't we, I'd like to bring back all the panelists on this. And while they're coming on, I think we're going to start at the very beginning at towards the last mile of this and you know, single-use plastics and being able to reduce, reuse, recycle. You know, we can't solve the waste crisis at this point, but this is a key part that we're trying to really, the voice has happened and sprouted up over the last couple of years with a lot of people. And I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about Matt, from a hospitality perspective. It'd be interesting to get your viewpoint on what you're doing in a hospitality and restaurant business around how do we manage the, you know, all of the packaging, the single-use packaging, and kind of the foundation of what the restaurants are doing in these new styles of packaging and prevention?
Absolutely. I think that we've seen a greater awareness and some of the low-hanging fruit in restaurants that are capable from a budgetary perspective. You've seen a shift away from plastic straws. We're seeing a shift towards compostability, and that there is some positivity there, and Hong Kong's been great for that. Unfortunately, and other parts of the world as well. Unfortunately, a lot of it though is slightly misleading. There's a big shift towards PLA, so plant-based plastics, but those still require industrial composting. And unfortunately, there isn't a great deal of separation that takes place. So it's one of those things where there's baby steps, but often they're not always the best steps. The biggest challenge that we're trying to look at is what happens behind the scenes. So cling wrap, sous vide bags, certain sachets and certain deliveries of things that are and safety protocols which still exist. And in fact, right now we're seeing a spike in that. You know, if you go to a hotel right now, everything that could be covered is covered with cling wraps and things due to the pandemic crisis. So almost a bit of a boomerang against this. So the solutions are there. And one of the things we've actually found and are testing and are now working with some of the leading hotel brands on is a compostable cling wrap, a truly compostable cling wrap that doesn't have toxins, that can go directly into a composter, could be, and doesn't require industrial composting. And that's a solution that we're really working on. But just to give you a perspective on the challenge, it's about 10 times more expensive than normal cling film or cling wrap. So it just gives you a sense of like the technologies are there, but that's a big jump for many people to make. And so we're trying to see if we can target different stakeholders. For example, could a delivery company give the restaurants that do the delivery when they're using a lot of plastic, could they substitute and help a restaurant use a better cling wrap and help pay the cost difference? So we're trying to have those type of conversations, trying to get more stakeholders around the table. Restaurants are notoriously difficult to make money, incredibly difficult when you're not even allowed to open, as a lot of people around the world are facing. So it is a really tough sector to address. But you know, there is definitely momentum, but it's chopping and changing. And it's not an easy fix.
Doesn't this kind of lead into the natural question about, yes, industrial, the environment, you know, the large scale recycling plants are, you know, years and years away in some cases. Hong Kong, actually, we're going to open one of our first ones, hopefully at the end of next year, I believe. But as we go into composting, isn't that such an incredible way that, you know, how do we design, how do we, you know, a lot of places really are not using that. I've seen in some of the Asia locations, you know, that becomes such an integral part of you know, composting a lot of our material and our waste and our thing. And it doesn't seem to be even on many people's radar at this point.
Well, we're hoping that developers can help. So we built a restaurant called John Anthony. We did a zero waste bar. So we put the composter inside the bar itself. So every piece of garnish, everything that came out of it would then go into our own composter so we could control the waste. And then we looked at the fruits that we were using and we bought a dehydration machine and we started dehydrating everything just before we would throw it away and then reuse it again in garnishing. We even looked at a way in which the one piece of waste we couldn't handle was the little bottle tops on the top of, say, a tonic bottle. And so we had to find a solution for that. There is ways of looking at every stream and having it within your own venue. The problem, of course, is it's an expensive thing to create. And that's where if landlords in malls and things like that started to offer that as a service to their tenants, these solutions could become a reality.
There's a question from Samantha. She's asking, it was a good question about on the packaging, you know, where it states that it's biodegradable or compostable, you know, how can we trust that this packaging is also authentic? And what does that mean as this comes into this bigger greenwashing?
It's tricky. I think that there's, I really applaud, you know, Doug's work in this regard. I mean, I think that we need some more centralization of understanding. I mean, I read a lot about logo fatigue. So, you know, if you look at a product now, it looks like kind of Lewis Hamilton's shirt. You know, it's got so many different logos that it's almost difficult to even see it. And then even after you've seen it, is it legitimately the case? And which ones are and aren't, you know? And, you know, a perfect example is like Oxy biodegradable. I mean, it sounds great, but it really is only really making everything smaller and this problem still exists. So that I think it's a really great point. I really believe that we need some global standards, and I hope that as larger corporations are looking at getting behind some of these changes. And I know they've been slow, and the film rightly pointed out that it's happening, but in tiny pockets around the world. But as they do commit to this more, if there was a standard, at least then they would get the benefit of making the shift, because the consumer would know, okay, that has that standard. You know, I think that Fair Trade did a very good job of that as a comparison. You know, people trusted that Fair Trade makes sense, a Fair Trade product had some standards to it. And if we could get that in the plastic compostability space, I think it would be very helpful for the industry at large.
Don't you think that we have to have a consumer voice in this discussion? Doug, you remind me, the first time I met you, it was, you were talking about, you do not want to get behind me in a grocery line, because I'm going to take apart all of the plastic they put on the coconuts and all of the other stuff. And I want them to be able, sure, they can ship it, but how are they reusing that? You know, and having a voice of the consumer, maybe talk a little bit about that, because every time somebody sees you walking into a store, I think that they run, right?
Well, I'm not that bad, but I know some people in town are, and it's not bad maybe to let the retailers know that we care about the stuff that they put on that we don't need, because unfortunately, a lot of the blame goes to the consumer. We are told that it is our fault and our responsibility to get rid of what we were given. And if the infrastructure and the resources aren't there in our house or the building or the city to put the things where we think they should go, maybe we do want to recycle. But if the trust has been lost, which it has been in many, many cities around the recycling effort, the consumers sometimes feel at a loss, and they're hopeless, and they're given these things without options. So consumers do have a voice, but they have to make the voice known. They have to be creative on social media and be legitimate with their questions in dialogue with the brands and asking them, you know, why do you have to package this way? And if you do, why are you not getting it back? Why are you, Mr. Retailer, not bringing it back from us through rewards program or bring back program, which brings economies of scale and efficiencies and pure feedstock streams, which all the recyclers need. Right now, most of the garbage around the world is bundled into black plastic bags with chicken grease and coffee grinds. And no one is going to spend the time and effort to sort through that unless they have a big mechanical sorting facility, of which, for example, Hong Kong has none. And that's why it's pretty tough here in a city which could be one of the best in the world, because everything's vertical and all of the populations are on top of each other.
So as we move it into then the next stage of that, and Tisa, interesting from that, and I think, you know, from a recycling perspective and in Asian communities specifically, how they have to start getting the community more involved in being able to even reward them, as we said, with, you know, how are we monetarily going to reward that? And shouldn't the brands take a position, you know, a part of that expense? And shouldn't that be saying, hey, you know, just like we used to with bottles and the other ones, you get that back. And how do we build some recycling? And there's interesting ones that are happening in Asia, start getting the community doing it in a little bit more way while we have to wait for the governments to catch up.
Yeah. So as Doug said earlier, there's a massive distrust in recycling right now, and the numbers aren't looking good, have never really looked good, but the numbers are out now, how recycling is only happening in about 9% of total plastic production. And so at the moment, consumers are frustrated with recycling labels. They're not trusting that things are going to get recycled. And that's those that are aware. Those that are not aware of the plastic problem will simply go about their usual business and not realize that the massive amount of plastic that they're using is actually not going to get recycled. So the first thing is to make everyone aware. But after that, because the problem seems to be super overwhelming and it has to require systemic change, and there is a challenge or a risk of consumers or ordinary citizens of falling into a fatigue or an apathy, or, you know, a feeling of helplessness, which is a shame. And I think that there are ways to do individual behavior, but I would encourage that these individual behaviors are tailored in a way that provides pressure on the system. So this is a bit different from you know, influencer talk, where if I were, I used to in the past, and 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I would usually say, as an individual, you can make a difference. Just change the way that you behave in your daily life. But now, nowadays, I would add a little bit of something to that. Like, you need to know how the system is not working. As an individual, that's your first responsibility. And then as you make these individual changes in your lifestyle, be conscious about how that's providing pressure on the existing system. So, like, for example, in a lot of Asian countries, in Indonesia, there's hundreds of waste banks popping up. I don't know if you're familiar with the term, everyone in the audience, but waste banks are basically where you deposit your waste by yourself. And when you go to a waste bank, you actually know which types of plastic or cardboard or cans are actually acceptable in the market, has market value, or in other words, gets recycled by someone.
But is that fair to put that on this? There was a question from Hanisha about this issue of waste generation on the consumers. Where do the brands' responsibility play into this? And I'm coming to you, Vic, be prepared. And the questions, key word about these are, it's just saying, how are the marketers going to change the conversation as well to take responsibility, to start building this into the design process? Along this way, it's not fair. Everyone feels like it's not fair for us to take this weight of burden. And what's the brand's position, do you think, across this?
It's absolutely not fair to put this burden on the consumer, but go ahead, Vic. Sorry.
No, Tisa, you're right. And I completely agree. It's not, the onus is not on the consumer, because it was not their problem to begin with. And I would just say, stop specking plastic. If you are going to be making a shoe, the designers and the developers are the ones who decide what materials actually end up on the shoe. If you've got a leather shoe, why would you slap a plastic swoosh on it and preserve that shoe for posterity in some landfill for 800 years just because you wanted a plastic swoosh on the shoe? I mean, it's dumb decisions like that that actually give the entire industry a bad name. And that's the kind of thing that one can avoid, is if you can just get the plastic off the product to begin with. Now, you can't do it 100% because outsoles are made of plastic. You've got TPU, you've got PU, you've got PET, you've got various forms of plastic that are unavoidable in today's modern day sneaker. You have to have it, but you can start getting biodegradable yarns on your textiles, for instance, instead of using plastics. Or you start using recycled plastics, for heaven's sake, but the recycled plastics do not solve the problem. They just alleviate the demise, so to speak, of what's happening with plastics and the brands. So not to make a long story out of this, there is no rocket science in this. The brands can do a lot more in using less plastics. I have a biased opinion in this because I'm in the sportswear industry. We are not the most egregious out of all the industries that are out there, fast-moving consumer goods. Unfortunately, the beverages industry or plastic bag manufacturers, so on and so forth, they actually contribute much more visibly and substantially to the problem. But what I would say is every industry has a responsibility to be able to take back and repurpose or recycle some of the stuff that they actually put on their product. And if you really do care for that, for the environment, stop using that much plastic. And there's definitely a lot more that the brands can do.
And then Robert asked on the flip side of that, said, why are governments not taking more affirmative action on this along the process? And maybe Thomas would be interesting from your experience as well in working with this. They have moved fairly quickly in the last couple of years, but it seems like they are, decades behind on this journey. What's your position on government?
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to governments, there's such a multitude of answers to that, because you can see countries like Germany, who have been incredible in terms of setting up the infrastructure for it and actually being able to process it at the consumer end. But I think, as the film showed, and as we've all talked about, that's only one element of the solution, because you need complete buy-in across, you know, consumers and industry to actually make that properly work. But, you know, we're not going to be able to recreate that model overnight across multiple geographies. So yes, some governments have got have sort of positioned themselves with a clear mandate to be able to tackle that at a sort of a infrastructure level, but that's really just not going to work. We can't deal with, I mean, it was clear in the film, as we can't deal with the level of volume that's coming through the system to be able to do that. So why have they been slow? I mean, I think this often comes down to priorities, right? I mean, they've got so many challenges. The UK, you know, perspective in some cases are doing quite well, but on many cases, they're terrible. They've got 100 other issues to be fighting right now. So what's interesting from this discussion, I think, and it comes out in multiple factors, environmental issues, you know, with some other commodities, is that you need educated consumers and end users to be able to put pressure on brands to be able to shift the way they do that. So if I decide I don't want to buy New Balance shoes because I don't like the way you're making those products, and I'm putting pressure on New Balance to shift the way they make things, I'm sure with more and more momentum, they will shift the way they do things. But equally, without the legislation to also force things to happen on a sort of a legally binding way, that's not going to work too. So I think we need this sort of pressure coming from all angles. And we see this same problem with other commodities, with soy, with palm oil, with lots of things. You've got so many multiple complex systems to be able to fix. It's not going to come just from a consumer. It's not going to come just from government. It's got to be a multitude of things. And I realize that's often the answer for many things, but it really is with plastics one of those things. We need it coming from multiple areas.
But we've heard this word daunting, you know, and everybody's overwhelmed by that. What are some of these key things that these beginning steps that we can take from a brand, you know, from a consumer? Obviously, we see, you know, you got to take a more active action, as you said, Tiza. But in your experience, you know, what are some of those key steps that we need to take immediately that we need to really shift before it is too late?
Well, I mean, as I said already, I think there's sort of a legally binding agreement somehow to actually force businesses and governments to be able to take responsibility for their supply chain. I mean, if you look at the incentives right now, if you're looking at the cost of virgin plastic versus recycling, virgin plastics will win over because it's so cheap. And so if you don't shift that incentive, it's never going to change because it's so much cheaper for you to go out. And we've got the same problem on a consumer level, right? So if I want to buy something on eBay or on Amazon or whatever, often it's just cheaper to get a new product shifted to me than go through a beautiful community system, which I know there are plenty of in London, where I've got to get in my car, drive down the road and pick up that secondhand sofa, which is probably fine to use, but actually it's easy to order it. So the incentives are all skewed all over the place. So actually we need shifting of incentives. I think, you know, if I can give an example, which I think is exciting, I don't know whether it will work, is TerraCycle's Loop, which some of you may have seen. It's that desirability which often comes into this. So TerraCycle, if some of you don't know, they're creating these quite beautiful reusable packaging for people to be able to buy their soap in and to buy their different products in. Now, it's not going to fix the whole system, but actually there's a desirability there where people will buy into it. And if brands get behind that, they're going to see brand loyalty, because they will say, oh, well, hang on a second, there's only two brands of soap which are giving me this beautiful metal container, which Loop will pick up and they will bring it to my door and change it. And actually that's quite exciting from a brand perspective, because if you bring in that desirability element, of course that doesn't work across the world. I mean, that's quite Western centric approach, but what can we learn from that?
And I think it's an interesting perspective too, because as we look at Western approach versus an Asian approach, or third world developing countries, there's this massive gap. And Tiza, it'd be interesting from your perspective in Asia, what you're seeing, because we don't have any of these systems in place right now. Yet the Western nations are continually firing us up and having, as an example in Asia, those single, everything's a single use. You know, they can't afford perhaps a larger part. So what do? We put it, every single thing in a single use plastic. So for one bottle of shampoo, I might have 500 plastic wrappers. And how do we blend the East versus West gap? And how do we fix that?
There is a gap, definitely, but it's not as big as you think. There is a misconception here as well in the Asian countries that we should emulate how the West manages their waste. Whereas in fact, the West is also not doing a good a great job at it and is in fact exporting their waste to developing countries. So we're all in this problem together. And actually, for when you look at the solutions, there's not that big of a gap either. The single-use plastic problem is a contemporary issue. I mean, I'm in my early 30s and I still remember a time when we still used reusables and refillables for everything. In the West, there's a, you know, there used to be a milkman who delivered milk in glass bottles and pick up the empty bottles the next day while delivering fresh ones. In Asian countries, we have similar, you know, systems where we would wrap our food in banana leaf, or we would get them in tiffins and just give them back to be washed by the food vendor. So there's actually a lot of that coming back now and being touted as a solution, and it really is a solution. When we can move to more reusables and refillables, and you know, for a vast majority of our conveniences in our contemporary lifestyle at the moment, we will be able to see a massive shift. And I think that there's lots of innovations out there where there's a shift back to reusables and refillables, but it's tailored to a modern society that shops online. Like I have a coffee vendor that I buy 1 liter cold brew coffee from in big glass bottles, and I just send it back and they send me back a new one filled, you know, with fresh coffee. So you know, and there are apps for that now. I think the key is that consumers need to be given a choice and need to demand a choice. I think it is strange how whenever we open a shopping platform online or we enter a mall, we have like a million products to choose from, but we don't have that much packaging options to choose from. When we check out from, you know, like an online platform shop, we've browsed like an hour for the right product. But when we check out, we're only given this, there's no option for what kind of packaging that we want. Now, some companies are starting to give that option. Like, do you want no plastic in your packaging? Do you want just old newspaper to package your product? Those are good. And those are what consumers should demand more of. And when we choose as a consumer to purchase these goods or demand that our favorite retailers give us that option, we're kind of slowly chipping in at the system and slowly making it more mainstream.
But don't we also have to go into, in the movie Story of Plastic, there was like, imagine you buy that can of tuna and it says this type of a labeling on the tier two, tier three problems or whatever that is, and you know, will you buy that as a consumer? And this comes into some key issues around labeling, I think, as well, that says, you know, where's, if you saw that, we won't do that. And Vic, it'd be interesting, and Doug also, from your perspective, to kind of say, what, you know, how do we also have to bring that level up to our packaging?
Doug, do you want to go on that, or I'd be more
than well happy. Yeah, sure. I mean, if I could touch on a few points that were made on the government side, you know, leadership around the world is tough when you've got short-term leaders and you've got big lobbies from businesses that say, we can't change this and that because the cost will be too high, the consumer has to pay, we'll take our factory to another country. So that is a big challenge. I really believe the brands and the companies have the ultimate most power in this whole story. Consumers sort of follow along. There is some power from the consumer, but the governments are usually defensive, but it's the companies who have the R&D, they have the marketing, the branding, the messaging, and actually in this case also the liability with their brand image, which carbon doesn't have because you can't see carbon, but all the products that we touch and throw away usually have a brand name on it. And if the consumer is not feeling that they have a good way to enjoy that product, even when it's done, then that's going to become a problem in the future. So now you have more and more companies looking for increased recycled content in their products, and consumers should demand that. Governments should put that in all of their tenders whenever they're buying large amounts of volume of products for the government. They should always have a recycled content minimum in it, and that will drive the pull factor for people to go out and collect this stuff and make a second use. So our plastic disclosure project is very much like carbon reporting. It's modeled on the same way, but if you don't measure what you have, you cannot manage it very well at all. And that's the big thing that every company, even every municipality, can do that today. It doesn't require bans, taxes, or legislative changes. So it can happen tomorrow morning. We announced this 10 years ago, could have happened 10 years ago, but the world wasn't quite ready to digest that. And there's no bad number. Some people think, oh, it's gonna make me look horrible. Well, the big power plants thought the exact same thing when they announced their carbon footprint in the first year. And the second year they got a bit more bold. And the third year they got very proud and said, wow, we figured this out. Now we've reduced it 10%, reduced another 10%. So now we can be saying we're bringing 50% recycled content into our shoes, into our bottles. And that begins a whole good story around this. And the problem is the supply chains to get the recycled content to these brands is almost non-existent. And when you have China ban the import of recycled plastic and many other countries, all of the brands who have manufacturing in those countries are going to have a very hard time to fulfill their recycled content goals, because they won't be able to get it very easily, because the domestic recycling is also not up to par to facilitate that kind of supply chain.
Matt, what are some of the key learnings that you've had, and one of your biggest suggestions for brands and companies moving forward? What actions can we take to really start activating quicker?
I mean, just slightly different from that question, but just on similar thing to Doug, I wanted to share an experience we had, and it kind of shows the interconnectivity of the importance of the different parties. So I actually grew up in Barbados, which is a tiny little island, and we persuaded the Barbadian government, after they saw the film and various other things, to ban single-use plastic. And so on the face of it, you're seeing a government make a great decision, do something right. But as soon as that happened, every industry started popping up and said, well, we're the meat processing industry. We use styrofoam and we wrap it in plastic and we need it. We need an exemption. And then the next industry said, well, we're this and we need an exemption. And before you knew it, a great decision ended up not really being effective because the solutions weren't there. And so it shows that the innovation needed to also come alongside. Otherwise, governmental input helps but doesn't solve the problem. And especially if you're a tiny island where you don't have anything near you, you need to import everything, you need to create everything. So it's a little microcosm of the whole world. And it kind of showed that as an example. So it was a really, and that's been a big inspiration for us to try and find more innovation. I was talking with Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and I think Ellen MacArthur have been one of the big voices in circular economies, and they've worked with some of the big multinationals. And I think they need help from other people to make sure the multinationals actually stay true to the promises that they made to them, which is, an ongoing problem. They said that, you know, when you look at the plastic solution, they said that they've tried to analyze what could be made circular. And the first 50% there were options available, maybe not the right price, but the last 25 doesn't exist today. And that the solution they could think of was to inspire grants from major companies to universities for innovation. So I'm not really giving you a specific answer as to what innovations I've seen, but it's an interesting mix to think of it. And they said that the biggest problem that they haven't got anywhere near a solution is the sachet, the small sachet, which is selling detergent, dishwashing things and things like that, that is sold in a sample form, is the thing that literally is not a solution for that today. In my industry, it's the sous vide bag. You cannot believe how many kitchens are using sous vide, and there is not a solution for that today. So that would be my thoughts on that.
Great. And Vic, you know, real quickly, as we wrap up here, from what advice you put to the marketers out there that really, you know, what voice, what should we be doing as marketers, you know, to move this at a light speed pathway?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, there's an immense bull factor with marketers today. With all due apologies to our audience today, I do want to tell you, a little story about my college-going daughter who recently purchased a down jacket for the Boston winter. She considered two brands, Patagonia and North Face, both of whom, were doing tremendous good for the environment. Patagonia scored higher on her scorecard, but she chose North Face. Why? Because it was $40 cheaper. So I said, I disdainfully told her, you care more for your money than you do for the planet. You're not willing to put your money where your mouth is. And she said, well, first of all, it's your money, not mine, that I'm trying to save. Number two, I don't have that kind of disposable income. So the demographic, there's a mismatch between who the marketers know are the passionate consumers who are actually passionate about the planet, but they don't necessarily have the disposable income to be able to support that kind of spend, so to speak. So my point being, greenwashing is very transparent to the consumers today. There are two things that surprised me with my daughter's actions. Number one, it told me that they have, until we achieve cost neutrality between eco-materials and recycled plastics, consumers must be willing to put their money where their mouth is, otherwise we are not going to be able to overcome that premium. Number two, greenwashing doesn't work anymore. What surprised me was the fact that my daughter didn't pay the extra money, but she spent the trouble to research who was actually doing a better job with the environment. So the marketers cannot be trying to hoodwink. Their consumers have to know that they have to be able to be sincere about working to help the environment. Because all it takes is one NGO to call you out on the river that you just polluted with your product. And it's very easy to do a forensics on that. I mean, the video, the movie actually showed us India and Chennai or Bangalore, I'm forgetting, where they actually started calling out the names of the brands that they were finding washing up on the shores, in the sachets and things that Matt just mentioned. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Cut the bull. Be a little more sincere about what it is that you're doing, because you'll protect your brand.
If I may, there's an interesting statistic. So I read, like most statistics, it's probably made up, but more than $1 trillion will be inherited by millennials over the course of the next 5 years. And more than 70% of millennials, at least in the United States, that were polled, are more inclined to buy a product that appears to have a conscience and that appears to have some green ethics. Now, that does lead to greenwashing, but it's an interesting statistic to see that you're right, that there is a huge amount of capital passing down through the generations as the booming baby boomers kind of sort of stops, obviously pass through. And so there is, I think, from a marketing perspective, a massive opportunity, and it is being definitely prioritized. And I hope people see it even more as that happens.
Well, I think that wraps up for our official time here. And we want to really thank all of you for taking the time. We hope you reach out to all the panelists and connect with that and find your local basics, what's happening in your own area. Don't get lost on the global level, understand the globe, but find that local level that you can participate in and take care of. And we want to thank everybody. And